Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends. But the truth is, he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous, intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as so he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Vish's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Ian Blurton is a multi-talented singer, musician, songwriter, producer, and live performer based in his hometown of Toronto, Ontario. As a producer, Blurton has worked on records by the likes of The Weaker Thans, Attack in Black, Hot Kid, Cursed, and Burning Love, among many others. As a singer and guitarist, he's renowned for his trailblazing work in his own bands like Change of Heart, Blurtonia, Come On, Public Animal, and most recently, Ian Blurton's Future Now, whose new album, Second Skin, might well be the most ambitious and fully realized record he's ever made. ahead of a Second Skin record release show at Toronto's Horseshoe Tavern on Saturday, August 13th, 2022, Ian returned to this show for a talk about making this album in Calgary's Studio Bell with the legendary Rolling Stones Mobile Studio, getting to use Neil Young's high-end studio gear and some of Randy Bachman's vintage guitars, how Glenn Milcham of Blue Rodeo goes absolutely ballistic on the drums whenever he works with Ian, and a brief history of the double kick pedal. Whether or not Toronto has been or ever will live up to its potential to be a cool city. Lyrical themes and threads connecting the songs on Second Skin and Ian's songwriting of late, album art collaborations, brand new music, other future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 707 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented dub enthusiast Ian Blurton with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hey, Ian, how's it going?
It's amazing. How are you?
Oh, I'm decent, thank you. Thank you very much. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in Toronto.
Nice. How are things in Toronto for you today? What's your day looking like?
This is my day, what I'm doing right now.
Just me?
Yep, just you, and then hanging out with cats.
Oh, well, that's a pretty good day.
Yeah, I like those kind of days.
How many cats do you have? You said cats, so several?
Two.
Oh, okay. What are their names?
Boots and Buttons.
Boots, you went with alliteration there. These are your cats in particular, or are they someone else?
Mine and my girlfriend's, yeah.
Okay, Aaron. Yeah, right. Boots and Buttons, are they good cats?
Oh, God, they're awesome, yeah.
Are you a cat person generally? Have you always had cats?
Yeah, I've had cats. I did. There was a stretch where there was no cats, but now there are cats again. Yes, I've pretty much always had a cat.
I miss my cat, Gary, every day. Passed away, 2014. Anyway, I miss him.
Right.
I can't replace animals. I have trouble. People are like, why don't you get another cat? Immediately. And I can't quite do it. I don't know what it is. I should probably just do it. I think it would be good. But there's did you go with the stretch without cats? Was someone in your life allergic or something?
No, I just, it just wasn't cat time.
It wasn't cat time.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, now just curious, because we have allergies here, and that's another problem. People get hyper allergic to the cats, more than the dogs, it seems.
Yeah. I was actually, when we first got the cats, I felt the allergies, but now it's gone again.
Oh, good. Well, I hope to hear from Boots and Buttons, at least one of them, during the course of our conversation. That would be fun. Now, I have a question to ask you right away about the lyrics, one set of lyrics on your wonderful new record. Oh, yeah, here we go. Here we go. So one of the lyrics on your new album, it stuck out for me. It's from the song Denim on Denim.
Yeah.
And you sing, "Who creates control?" And I want to tell you that I know the answer to this one. It's me. It's me.
It's you. Oh, I see. You create control.
I create control. You see, that's the name of the show. You see what I'm doing there? I assumed this was me swimming around in your heart and your mind. And then when you were penning your lyrics with your pen and your paper, you thought, this will be a little nod to Vish and his amazing podcast.
There's actually a bunch of little nods to Canadian things in the lyrics. There's a... The chorus in Second Skin is the Ghosts of Modern Man, who were a band from Regina that I absolutely loved. So there's, there's some stuff like that.
What we call here, for those listening around the world, we have a thing that's mandated by our broadcast regulator. We call it CanCon, which is a way of calling it Canadian content. So you have loaded this brilliant new record with CanCon. Is that what you're saying, Ian?
Yeah. Oh, it's full of CanCon. Yeah.
It is a wonderful, wonderful record. I can't stop listening to it. I was going to save this to later, but I am going to put this out there. I feel like this is maybe your best record. The most It feels like your most ambitious record. I don't know how else to put it. And I'm generalizing, and I'm going by the raw emotion I have in listening to the record a lot lately. And I'm sure if I picked up a Change of Heart record or maybe even the last Future Now record, I'd be like, you know what? I was wrong. This is the best thing Ian's done. Or a Come On record. You know I'm a fan, right. But this feels... you know what? Let's go with this. How do you feel about this record in relation to others? Does it feel particularly... Are you particularly proud of this one? I know it's the newest one, so I'm gathering you might want to be like, of course. But if you think on it, doesn't this feel like... It feels like a lot of work. Does it feel like maybe the most elaborate thing you've done?
It's definitely the most elaborate outside of Smile,
right,
probably.
Right.
Like in terms of like the amount of work that went into it. Not that less work goes into other things, but just the 7 minute, there's 4 7-minute songs on the record. So just getting those things to work properly, or at least what I think is working properly. Took a lot of work.
Yeah.
And just having more keyboards and stuff. Yeah. It's just more expand. The arrangements are a lot bigger than normal,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. I'm glad you can relate to what I'm saying. Cause I know, hearing a compliment like that or a generalization like that even can be like, what the fuck? What am I supposed to say to this?
Right.
But it feels to me like you're on the same page that I am. I'm hearing it. Do you know what spurred this on at this moment in time for you to go particularly whole hog on a record?
Well, actually, we were invited to be part of the Arts Residence program at the National Music Center, Studio Bell. And two things there that were probably influenced everything was one, we were going to record on the Rolling Stones mobile, so like Led Zeppelin 3, Led Zeppelin 4, Exile on Main Street, Deep Purple Machine Head, Status Quo Live at the Apollo in Glasgow, all these amazing records made on this in this truck. And so I think there was like hopefully this record's going to be good, let's work our asses off on it. And the other thing was that you get to choose stuff from the collection, and one of the things I chose was a Mellotron. So immediately, once we got the artist in residence, the Mellotron became part of the songwriting process.
And for those who don't know, what exactly is a Mellotron? What does it do? What does it spur someone like you on to do?
Mellotron is it's pretty much one of the original samplers, in that each key that you hit has a piece of tape that runs, I think it's roughly 8 seconds. And so it has flutes or boys choir. Like you can change the tapes to different things. And some people actually, you know, go random. So like one note will be a boys choir. And so they just sat a Mellotron in front of me and I noodled on it for, 5 days and did what I could.
Did you replace any of that tape with something of your own?
No. I just went straight with what they had because it sounded great. Honestly, just love the way it sounded.
Now, I don't know if you know this, but my son, Levon, and I have been inside of that Rolling Stones mobile truck. Did you know this? I posted photos on one of the socials many years ago. I think we were there in, I want to say it was 2018. And we got a nice tour, and they gave us some, I don't know, how did this occur? Somebody reached out to me on socials to be like, hey, I see you're in Alberta. This was before we moved here. And do you want to come get a special tour of the National Music Center? I was like, oh, sure. That sounds great. So we stopped into Calgary and we went. Anyway, it was really magical for me to be inside that truck. I tried to instill the magic in my son. He was like, what? Who the rolling what? What is it? What is this, an ice cream truck? What is this? I don't understand.
Did they have souvlaki on this thing or what?
He thought it was a food truck. It is actually, if you think on it, it's basically a food truck-sized vehicle, right?
Oh, 100% it is a food truck-sized vehicle.
Yeah, right. So those of us who follow music know that producers like yourself or engineers or rooms... you would go into as a musician, or you would work with someone, maybe with an expectation of what you're going to get on the other end, because they have a sound. The room has a sound. The board has a sound. The producer or the engineer has a signature way of recording things. What was it about the truck that excited you, first of all, the notion of using this historical truck, you know, as you mentioned, all the records made on it. But what did you think you were going to get out of it? And also, at the end of the day, do you think you got what you were hoping for?
That's a big question. Just honestly, the truck was, it's what you described. It's just like the fact that we were able to be in this magical space that, like, you know, for me, so many of my heroes have been in that truck, probably smoking a cigarette, listening to playback, going, ah, no, we got to do it again. Or, you know, like, you know, Steve Marriott or Bebop Deluxe and, you know, just like all these bands. So there's the, and, you know, being a fan of that kind of stuff, that's a historical, yeah, it's a, you know, it's a monument. It's like one of the greatest studios ever made. The expectation is like, because I had never really worked on a Helios console, specifically that one before, I didn't know how it was going to sound. But, you know, the staff at the Studio Bell are just fantastic. They took care of us. They made it sound great. They took a lot of pressure off, actually, because having only 4 days to record all the beds was a little like, ah. And then we played a live show on the fourth night. So we had really only been playing these songs for like 4 days, and then we had to play a show. So it was like, it was a little bit of pressure.
Did you break out the new songs for that show?
Oh yeah, we played the whole record actually. At the show.
Okay, cool.
And then played another set of, you know, what we've been playing, basically.
So just to be clear, we've described the Rolling Stones mobile truck as a food truck sized vehicle. The band is not in the truck recording. The truck itself is basically like a control room.
The truck, in fact, was on the main floor, and we were on, I believe, the third floor. Oh. And we weren't actually using the truck, because the whole place is tied together, too, by tie lines.
Yeah.
And actually, we weren't using the truck for playback, because it was like a lot of up and down.
Yeah.
So we just went, we had another studio that we would go into and listen to playback on.
Are you anti-exercise? You didn't want to go up and down the steps a lot? Is that what you're saying to me?
Yes. We asked for like chauffeur-driven like golf carts, but they were like, no.
Golf carts to take into the elevator up and down, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, they're big elevators.
They are. It's a wonderful...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't mean to make this a travel and tourism segment, but it's a really wonderful facility, that place.
I really liked it. Yeah.
Okay, so I can understand what you're getting at. I feel like as a musician, if you know you're either working with someone or working in a place that has historical significance, you just play in a psyched up way. You're psyched. So that's kind of...
We were psyched, and we were also like, ah!
Was it nerve-wracking?
Well, yeah, because like the first day we tried to get one song for I don't know how long, and it did not happen.
I see.
So we were under even more pressure, and then everything started clicking. It was like, you know, you get to that point where you're like, the nerves wear off and you're just like, oh my God, we got a lot to do. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, for example, like another thing was like the kick drum microphone, they had just bought it from Neil Young. And like, you know, it was like the vocal mic he used for everything for like 30 years. So it's like, you're just surrounded by this stuff. And if you can't rise up in a situation like that, then... Ugh. You know, like Randy Bachman had dropped off 250 guitars. Like Aaron, who's the other guitar player, I'm a lefty, so he won this lottery.
Right.
But, you know, he's playing like a 59 Strat, and he's playing, you know, somebody dropped off an Explorer for him. And just like, you know, a lot of the people in the community brought like the band Woodhawk and Carl Chappell. Sorry, I hope that's how you pronounce his last name.
Yeah.
Brought gear to us just for free, you know, just to try and help us make a better record. So it's like, you know, the whole village thing, a lot of people really helped. So it's like, don't make a shitty record.
That's amazing. So you basically were playing in a living museum across the board. It wasn't just the mobile studio. You've got...
Oh, no, it's the whole place. Yeah. It's the whole place. Yeah, like even the Mellotron that I was using, like Mellotron went out of business and another company bought them, and they... basically sort of rebranded them and slapped a bunch together and sold them. And I was using one of the weird ones. So it's like, it was even a rare Mellotron,
yeah.
You know?
One of the major attractions at the music center there is the Tonto synthesizer, yes. Which I believe it's up a couple floors. I want to say, I can't remember, but I think it's on the It's higher, right? It's not on the main floor.
I think it is. Yeah.
So this was most recently made sort of famous, I guess, by our friend, our colleague, Robin Hatch, made a record using that thing. Did you use that in any way? Did you want to try to incorporate that?
No, I don't. I think that would have been, I think that's the kind of thing where you kind of spend 5 days with it.
Yeah.
You know, like just that thing. Because it's massive. Like, as people probably don't know how big it is, but it's, I don't know, 15 feet across?
No, it's, it's huge.
It's huge.
Yeah.
It's huge. Rich Acoin actually also made a record on it recently as well.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, and I don't want to mangle the history, but yeah, this was like one of the first synthesizers, I believe.
Well, it's like one of the first synthesizers that has like a couple of drum machines, a couple of bass type things, a synth. I believe it takes a couple of people to run the thing.
Yes, that's right.
And then Stevie would sort of... it was built for Stevie Wonder.
It was built for Stevie Wonder. That's correct. Yeah.
And he would just basically jam out in the middle of it with a bunch of people, helping him out.
Right.
And then it's also in Phantom of the Paradise. In the scenes where he's playing keyboards and there's like this big thing behind him, that's also the
top. Oh, wow. Okay. So I don't recall the whole story, but it ended up in Calgary and it's there. And like I say, Robin made a record. And Robin's on your record is where I was coming from too. Played some piano, I want to say.
Yes, she played piano.
Yeah, right.
Incredible. I have nothing but respect for Robin. She's amazing.
Yeah, she's very funny too.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah, she's great to work with, period.
I find in person sometimes Robin can be very quiet, but she's really doing well on the show. And I know her, and she was on the show, I want to say, this year or last year. I can't remember now. And it was fun. So yeah, I like her. I like her a lot. I'm glad you made that connection. So anyway... Given the intricacy of these arrangements and the challenges you're putting on people in your band, how much demoing did you do of these songs versus how much stuff you were like working on together in that space or other spaces? Did you do a lot of did you do a lot of demos?
Well, Glenn and I did demos for everything just to get the tempos and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
Anna and Aaron were a little more busy, so it was more like Glenn and I sort of hashing things out. And then it was really the four of us for those 4 days. It was definitely the four of us throwing ideas around and just trying to make everything work, you know?
Yeah.
There's actually no production credit on the record because there was just so many people involved. Hmm. It would have been like executive producer, just because it really was like everyone had at least one or two great ideas that worked their way onto the record. So.
I think we've covered this in the past because both you and Glenn were on this show when Change of Heart was kind of reassembling there for a little bit. And then I believe you and I talked about the last Future Now record on this show as well. But can we talk a little bit for those who had missed all of that stuff? It's been a few years. Glenn Milcham, for those who don't know, is the drummer in Blue Rodeo. And Blue Rodeo has a particular sound. Here in Future Now, he's a monster. He's a punk rock, borderline metal drummer. Lots of double kick. You mentioned Neil Young's...
Yeah.
I feel like you said Neil Young's vocal microphone was employed as the kick drum mic. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I believe so, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
I mean, it's a great... It's a $5,000 mic or whatever, so it can be used for... Whatever the
Do you know the story about why Mr. Young would want to have rid himself of that thing, sell it to the center? Did they tell you?
He actually sold a bunch of things to them. I think he put up a lot somewhere, and they bought I know they bought the Ampeg flip top bass amps. You know,
I do.
So they had two of those that Crazy Horse used apparently almost on every record, and they bought both of them. And that microphone. So
I wonder why
they're just slowly amassing, just stuff, Canadian stuff.
I understand why the center would be completely stoked to get that stuff and put up some dough. I guess I wonder why Neil. I keep calling him Mr. Young, like he's my teacher. But why I wonder why Neil would have gotten rid of that stuff because he's still active and the Crazy Horse is. I mean, you don't know. Did they tell you anything about this? Like why?
No, I think, no, I have no idea why.
Curious.
No. Huh. He's probably got five of them.
No, I know, I gather that he's not you like, know? Now what am I going to do? I sold all my amps. I'm sure he's not that, you know, thinking that way, but that's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. These are like none of his, like, you know, classic amps that he's been using. You know, he's been using the same amp since I think it's 68 or something.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah. Anyway, sorry, back to Glenn.
Enough about Neil Young.
Well, I noticed the double kick more prominently on this record. And as a drummer myself, I've never employed the thing. And I assume for the most part in Blue Rodeo, Glenn is not double kicking. I can't think.
Glenn is not double kicking in Blue Rodeo. No. I'm almost 100% sure of that.
So this is I'm sure he's so excited to have this outlet. Does he play with others beyond you and Blue Rodeo these days? Drums, I mean?
Oh, God, yeah. He's in a million. Okay. He's in a million bands. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But anything like this, like where he can go nuts?
I don't think so. Yeah. I know that just from being a producer, when I'm like, go crazy on the drums, most drummers are like, what? What? Most of the time now, it's like, can we do the opposite? Can you just play time?
Yes, you know, of course. Kind of right. Because you need to. The drummer is foundational. You don't want them going too crazy. It ruins the.
Right.
It will ruin every take if they suddenly go crazy. But, okay, let's just circle back
to. We were like, Glenn, this is your record. Go nuts.
So did you have any input into how he played, when he did? So he'll be playing like a pretty normal, to me, like a fairly normal rhythm part, and then all of a sudden I'll hear those, and it's great. It's like a nice texture, and it's fascinating. Did you have any input in terms of when to employ that thing, or
I'm pretty sure I'm like, this is a double kick part. I'm sure I've said that at least once. But I know for sure that, like, yeah, we did push him to go a little more crazy than what would normally be, like in Second Skin, in the, you know, what is a big vocal part. Even he said this, it's like, you know, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this here. It's like, well, maybe you should.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. For those of us who don't know the history of the double kick, and I can't say that I do, I feel like I didn't really come across it until 80s metal kind of stuff. Is that roughly? Right. Or maybe some 70s prog probably employed it, but.
Oh, there's tons of 70s bands with double kick. Tons.
But like Bonham wouldn't have done it, right? Bonham just had a...
Oh, God, no.
Right.
But Bill Ward,
Yeah.
Yeah, there's... Oh, God, now I'm going to just draw a blank.
No, it's fine.
Tommy Aldrich, you know, basically perfected the simple double kick. I mean, Motorhead, obviously,
yes,
you know, like...
Yes,
and that's the kind of double kick that, like, I think that we're talking about. We're not talking about like new extreme metal double kick,
no,
like, which is like, you know, it's like,
yeah, it seems to in some circles the double kick is became a bit of a cliche,
yes,
a bit of like a thing to almost disparage or slightly make fun of, you know. But is it coming back? Do you know something I don't? Is it
I don't know. We're bringing it back, baby. I don't know. It just seemed like, I said this to you before, but like, just when I started writing the material for this band, it was like, oh, God, this really needs double kick.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Fair enough. Now, you knew Glenn before he was in Blue Rodeo, right? He was in...
I've known Glenn since, oh, my God, 84?
Yes.
Like, I was, you know, I used to go see Vital Signs, which was the band he was in at the time, and... You know, he played in, he was in Change of Heart on Smile, which is 92. He was my neighbor around that time period, 90, 92.
Yeah.
You know, I've known him for a long time.
So when you first started working together in Change of Heart, is that fair?
Yeah. I feel like we jammed before that sometime, but I don't know. Yeah, Change of Heart's the first, like, serious time.
So when you used to see him, again, the Blue Rodeo period is what people would know him best for, and it's not the kind of drumming that we're describing right now. When you would see him in Vital Signs or other bands, was he more like the Future Now drummer that he is today, or what was he?
Yeah, I mean, well, Vital Signs was more of a post-punk vibe,
yeah.
But definitely lots of polyrhythms and stuff. Actually, he showed me a drum beat to one of the songs like a couple of weeks ago, and it was like, wow, that's really intricate drum part there you got.
Yeah, and he would have been kind of a kid on some level at that point.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I used to go see him with Garbage Man and, like, oh, God, White Noise, which is more jazz and, you know.
So you two, like, I'm trying to jog my own memory here because of that change of heart conversation we had. You two kind of reconnected as collaborators around the time of the change of heart reassembly for Smile. Is that right?
Well, actually, yeah, after it, I was like, I guess I just, you know, we'd just done a bunch of shows. And I think I was just like, yeah, you know, there's the guys right in front of me.
Yeah.
You know, it was like him and Damon were played drums on the, who were both Change of Heart drummers, played on the first record, The Signals Through the Flames. So.
Right. That's right. Right. Okay. So what's that like for you to get to reconnect with Glenn in particular?
Fantastic. I have so much respect for him as a human and as a musician, and we get along great. He's opinionated. I'm opinionated. We throw opinions back and forth. We make music. It's great. And, you know, I always, you know, like if you find somebody who can just play parts that you don't even have to think about it, you're just like, this is how this song goes. And then he goes, oh, yeah, no, this is how this song goes, or she goes. It's great. Yeah.
Sometime in the last 12 years, I want to say, Glenn put out a solo record that I really enjoyed. And it was like a more of a post-punk, I would say, thing. It was surprising to me as someone who knew him primarily as a guy in Blue Rodeo. Did he contribute to your songwriting in any beyond the drumming, obviously, but is he opinionated about lyrics? Is he opinionated about arrangements, that sort of thing?
Lyrics, I don't think so. I don't know. We've never had that conversation, really.
Hmm.
And actually, I should say, I produced one of the Swallows records, which is a band that he had in between the two playings together.
Well, maybe so that's, is that what I'm referring to, maybe?
I don't know.
I can't remember.
There's a bunch.
Did he do a solo record?
He's done a bunch of solo records.
Yeah, okay, sorry. I ended up working a little bit with whoever was representing him at the time to write the album bio. It might have been, I don't think it was a Swallows record. I think it was his own thing. But sorry, yeah. he would know, and I feel badly now.
No.
My memory is melting. Sorry. But no, so.
Yes, he did contribute because he came up with a drum part, which I believe is in 13.8. And it was like we had finished recording in Calgary, and I was like, I think we need another couple of songs for the record. And I was like, do you have a drum beat? And he threw down this 13.8 drum beat, and then I wrote a song around it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. So he arranged...
Which is something I love doing. It's, you know, like when a drummer can just be like, here's a beat, and we're going to write a song around it.
Did you say what song it was? I don't know if you identified it. I might have missed that.
Trails to the Gate. It's the last song.
The last song. Yes. It's a fascinating one in itself. Let's talk about the... Well, it is. It starts off differently than some of the others. You've got the, as I recall, off the top of my head... It starts with these vocals, right? These multi...
Yeah.
You did a lot of multi-tracked vocals, maybe more than usual. I can't...
way more than usual. Yeah, yeah,
What was going on there? Sorry, I don't mean to do armchair psychology, but I'm always fascinated by what comes out of a pandemic when people are isolated and making stuff a lot on their own. Because you were really...
And left to their own devices.
Left to their own devices, yes. But you were quite diligent, I thought, about sharing the progress of your work on this record on Instagram in particular.
Right.
And it was often you layering, I think most, in my memory, you were layering guitars yourself, I think. Probably you and Aaron, maybe. Is that right?
Yeah.
But putting that out there, I mean, this is a new tool and a new practice. You know, back in our day, in the old days, people would quietly make their records and you would not really get too many progress reports unless you were in like a fan club or something, right?
Yeah, we would send out postcards.
would you
Well, it's true. I mean, it's like we used to do Change for our postcards all the time and be like, oh, we're in the studio.
Oh, I didn't know you did that. Okay, that's interesting.
No, yeah.
So you like the notion. That's a connection thing is where I'm coming from. And like you're connecting with people, like whether you're communicating something and hoping that it connects with people. And I appreciate that. But when someone in a period of isolation creates a gang vocals by themselves, I'm guessing, did you do most of the singing on the record? Did anyone else?
Well, actually, what happened, being as the pandemic took as long as it did, I had laid out the vocals for other people to sing.
Oh.
And there was, you know, Glenn and Anna and Aaron actually sing on the record. Oh, no, wait. Yeah. And... I had done a lot more for them to do, and I just sort of ran out of money and ran out of time and patience and just all that stuff. It sort of all came to a head, and I'm like, well, you know what? This is just going to have to do.
Absolutely. So where I'm coming from is the armchair psychologist trying to figure out why people do the things they do in a pandemic. You're in lockdown. You create music that sounds like as many people as possible. Almost every song. Is there a song that doesn't have multi-track vocals? I don't think there is. I feel like they all have it. And I wonder if that's telling of something, of like trying to create a little community of voices for every song so it doesn't sound so sparse and stark and locked down like someone's by themselves. That's where I'm kind of coming from. You know what I'm saying?
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I didn't even think about that. But yeah, that I could see that.
It's a production thing to do.
And you know, also like we wanted everything to be like, there was kind of sort of two rules for the record is like, A, be crazy and as over the top as possible. And also when the stupid parts happen, like make them as dumb as possible.
Oh,
so it's like to kind of offset the fact that like you have these sections where yes, there are like, you know, lots of vocals going on, but like when we get to a simple part, let's try and make it as simple as possible.
Well, the guitar parts are amazing. Like I'm not trying to blow smoke. I just think it's, like I say, as a fan of yours, I'm like, man, a lot of thought went into this and there's so many intricate parts. Like I wish I could see it live, but here I am in Alberta and I don't know if you do an album release show, where better to do it than maybe at that music center? I don't know. Maybe someday you'll do that if there's time.
That would be amazing. I would love that.
Full circle. Yeah. Anyway, it's really, really elaborate musically is I think what we've established. Let's talk about it. I made a little joke about the lyrics at the beginning, of course, but conceptually, I hear threads running through this record. I hear rallying cries. I hear your usual, I think, blend of hope and some measure of rage.
Fuck you.
Yes, I hear that. It's a signature calling for you, but this feels more narrative based. I hear concepts, but I don't want to put too much on it. Can you speak to this? Is there something going on this record?
Oh yeah, I mean, like you know, like you know, the whole, that's the part of the prog side of things that I think that we were sort of going for. It's not like a concept record, but there's like a narrative of, you know, well, the second skin of like, if you do fuck something up, there is something that you can do to make it better. Or, you know, watching the city be torn down and like in a way that's like not helpful for, you know, a lot of like, homeless and like, you know, bike paths and just like all this kind of stuff. I mean, Toronto could right now be transforming itself into something that in the way like Paris is doing, or even Kitchener, Ontario, like they just announced the amazing amount of bike paths and stuff. And I just feel like we're regressing sometimes. The people here are amazing though. And that's probably where what you're talking about, the hope and the positivity or whatever. It's just the people that are here really make it worthwhile. Otherwise it would just be, oh God.
Yeah. Contextually, I know you are a Torontonian, more than most Torontonians I know. You are a born and bred Toronto person. I know you love...
I was actually not born here.
Oh, I correct my statement and retract it. Where were you born?
I'm American.
Are you?
Yeah.
Where were you?
I was born in Illinois.
Oh, shit. I knew that, actually. I'm sorry. But you are... Yeah. When did you get to Toronto?
Oh, a long time ago. Long time ago.
You are pretty Toronto-y.
I am Toronto.
You're more Toronto than Illinois at this point. Let's say that. How about that?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
for sure.
I mean, you have... Are you proud to be from... Despite what you're saying, I think you, in a hopeful way, you're a proud citizen of Toronto. Is that fair?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I love Toronto. I mean, obviously the music community here is, you know... Well, it's as good as anywhere in the world. Let's be real, like in terms of anything.
Yeah.
And just, you know, things like food, and I love the neighborhoods, and, you know, I love all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's the infrastructure and the political leadership that you're frustrated with.
I'm questioning, spending, in whatever, yeah.
Has it...
We could go into another conversation that could be another hour.
But I just want to get to this, because contextually, I know you're from Toronto. I know you're probably, although you never reference it specifically on this record, I know the things you're talking about when you say they're tearing the city down to build it back up. Like, Toronto is notoriously a construction city. It just seems to be in perpetual gentrification or something. I don't know. The jokes that I would hear from comedians whenever, every year I went to JFL 42, which is the Just for Laughs Toronto edition. I forget what the 42 acts, I guess. Anyway, the common, every year someone would make this joke. Hey, it's great to be here in Toronto. Great city. It'll be even better when you finish it. Because it was just always, always under construction. You can't go anywhere. So anyway, right. Sorry. I don't know if you're getting to... I assume that's an allusion to that. This constant cranes in the air.
Yeah.
And
Well, yeah. Supposedly we had, you know, at one point, I think it was last year, we had like as many cranes as almost anywhere in the world up.
Yeah.
And just, you know, tearing down some absolutely gorgeous... the whole... front, just leaving the front of a building up, just
the facade.
Man, that
yeah,
bums me out. Yeah, that bums me out.
Yeah. So where I'm coming from again is I can pick up on the Toronto parts of this record myself.
But that's you know, that's also universal. That's, I think that's happening everywhere. You know,
that's where I'm coming from.
You know, just the monoculture. You know, like. Which, you know, the average person I don't think wants that. You know,
but when in your lifetime. Did you ever feel on a political leadership level or an infrastructural level, urban planning level, was there ever a period where you're like, I think things are actually going to be okay. I like the mayor. I like the council. I think we're going to be all right. Have you ever totally felt, like if you think on it.
I think I was on tour in the Netherlands when I felt that. Certainly not in Toronto.
Oh, really?
Well, actually, you know, I just think like, oh, actually, you know, some of the mayors in the 70s and stuff were pretty rad.
Yes,
you know,
and you were around, but you were a kid, I'm guessing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So you were
not
like,
that old.
No, I know. I'm just trying to contextualize. So in the 70s, you felt. What I'm saying is, as a child or as a kid, as a teen, you may not realize the power we all had to impact the decisions that are made. So you might be like, oh, I think that, and we tend to be more trusting. You can be cynical and scrutinize things, but you tend to. Have to out of necessity be like, I think the leaders know what they're doing. I have to think that. Otherwise, I'm going to be depressed and not be able to function. But then as you get.
I don't think I've ever thought that. No.
Okay. So what I'm getting at is in my lifetime, I can't think of a time where I felt like Torontonians were happy with what was going on. Like in general, my friend Noah23 has a lyric that I always think is funny. It's pissed off like I'm living in Toronto. And because there's just this agitation, like I know you love it, but there's this sense that it could be, there's always this sense that it could be something better than it is, that it's not living up to its potential. Does that resonate with you?
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's like, that's sort of, I think something that driving at maybe a little bit is that the potential, I mean, yeah, like the parkland and stuff that we have and just... I mean, I don't have the solutions, obviously.
No.
I'm a rock musician. But just seeing the way other cities are doing it, you know, like Paris bringing in all those bike paths as well, you know, and just realizing that this is a good time to be doing that kind of stuff as opposed to waiting. And like, and then in Toronto, it's like we close the lakeshore down for bikes for a day. And the guy from the Blue Jays is like, oh, we can't have that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, but the Indy 500 or their Indy,
it's called F1. It's called something else. The Molson or
whatever. The race cars go around
Lakeshore. Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
You know, it's like no one's going to complain about closing that. You know, no one's going to be like, oh, we should close that down. You know.
Well, I mean, I'll just to be clear for people who haven't maybe been to Toronto, there are bike lanes of some kind. It's not totally, but it's all like some residue from when there was some sort of progressive leadership, whether provincially or in a municipal sense, right? It's just the current. I'll tell you, like on the list of reasons why. We left Ontario for, it's going to sound perverse to you because we moved to Alberta, which if Ontario has a conservative leadership, then Alberta has an ultra-conservative leadership. But they followed an NDP, which is, and for all intents and purposes, one of the most left-leaning governments, parties rather, that we have in Canada. Anyway, my point is, on the list of things for me about the decision to leave was the government at the time, the provincial government, because they were kind of, and I feel like everyone's, and they just won again. They got reelected. Your hope is to wait these people out. How did you feel about, sorry, I don't know what your political affiliations are. I have a sense of them. How did you feel? How did you feel about that?
Oh, it was a bummer. I don't know. I don't know what to say. You know, it's like, he's just not my type of person at all.
I just mean, like, if you're, we've talked about the hope for change in you, and then you see something like that happens, it must impact that hope. It must diminish it just a little, or do you just...
Well, I just see so much, you know, I live in Parkdale, and I just see so much action of people helping people here, that it's really easy to be inspired by that. Like, I live right beside Park, which is like, you know, the Parkdale drop-in center.
Yeah.
So I see these people in walking in and out of there every day. So it's like, it's easy to see positive things happening, you know?
I will say, just to give you some perspective. So yesterday I decided to ride my bike to the bank machine because the phone wouldn't read the check I got. So I was like, I got to go put it in the real machine. And I biked there, and there's nothing. There's no bike lanes at all from my house to the downtown, it's pretty close to downtown bank. I had to ride the light rail. I had to ride on the currently not functional light rail track. This is the only place I could get away from the cars. My wife started biking to work. She works at the University of Alberta. And the first day, someone in a car, not the car itself, they haven't become sentient. Someone in the car screamed, "Hey, you biker, get off the road." And we're in Edmonton, which is the most progressive part of this province. All I'm getting at is things could be way worse
in
Toronto. And anyway, sorry. Let's talk a little bit more about this narrative, the second skin concept. Second skin as a lyrical motif pops up a few times on this record. It seems to be a central theme. And why? What is that? You alluded to what it might mean, but what?
Well, it's just, it's not even necessarily rebirth. It's like, you know, you just wait, you know, sometimes in life you just wake up one day and you realize you've gotten to a new point in your life without even necessarily noticing it. It's just something in you has evolved and brought you to that point, and that's sort of what it's about as well.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. Discussing lyrics is weird.
Yeah, you alluded to, just so people know, I'll give people a little bit of inside baseball here. I asked you for the lyric sheet and it took you a while. You didn't want to, I don't think you were happy to send it, but I appreciate that. However, I can tell by reading them, you've spent a fair amount of time thinking about them. And I know from our past and our interactions and the sounds of your records, I have a sense of who your influences are musically. I don't recall ever really asking you questions about narrative storytellers that have inspired you, whether they're authors or writers. I'm picking up on those influences a bit. Sorry, not to discount any great songwriters. I know there's a long history.
No.
A long history in metal and punk and all rock idioms, frankly, of people trying to connect their songs with some sort of narrative thread. And they go, some people are very famous for this. They draw upon literature or they draw upon something and they create, like I said, I asked you to send me the lyric sheet because I like, first of all, I love to read. Second of all, I on a sensory level, get something out of reading someone's lyric sheet without the singer singing at me. In isolation, I like to read the lyrics as like a poem or prose or whatever. In your case, on this record, it's obviously poetic, but it almost seems more prose-y, if you will. So, back to my original... I don't know if you know this, Ian. Sometimes I stall so I can give people a chance to think about the question. I'm not just rambling. This is tactful because I know I've asked you a big one. Do you have particular narrative influences, maybe outside of music, that you draw upon when you're conceiving of lyrics for a record, like particularly like this one?
Oh my God.
Do you need me to stall longer?
Yeah, a lot longer. No, I think it's maybe just all the stuff I've read has probably, you know, the thesaurus was the biggest reading thing for this record, you know, like, that was probably the biggest thing, but you know, just like, God, I don't know.
No, it's fair. Like I say, it's a big question. I don't need specifics necessarily, but as a storyteller, I'm like, this might be your most ambitious record. This sounds like it took a lot more out of you than maybe others in some ways. You have done all sorts of things. You've written sort of pop songs. You've written punk, like short blasts of music that are expressing feelings and thoughts. This just seems a little more focused, and I can't help but wonder if that is a result of you being like, I really want to say something on this whole record. This whole record is a statement. It's not just song, 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 and one feeling follows another. That's where I'm coming from. So I can't help but wonder if you draw upon people who have had similar ambitions of like trying to tell some sort of narrative over the course of a record.
Oh, man. I don't think I ever go like, oh, I want to make a statement. That I know that for sure.
Right. Are you saying the concept just emerged? Like you this could have been.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I actually, the way I work is very like, I just go with whatever's going. Hmm. And then after the fact, if I don't like it, then it's gone. But up until that moment, I just work on it through instinct.
Yeah.
And just sort of go with whatever happens. So the concept emerged because that Second Skin song actually came very early in the whole thing. And I was like, well, this is something we could explore. I mean, because like, you know, there's things like Alice Cooper School's Out, for example, even though you probably wouldn't hear the influence on this record, it is very, there is a strong influence because one of the things they do is they bring back musical themes throughout that record.
Yeah.
And, the Second Skin chorus comes, you know, happens three times in the song, every time in a different key, and then it comes back at the whole end of the record one more time in a different key. So
yeah,
there's just little things like that. So yeah, I guess looking at things like, I mean, Bob Ezrin Productions, he always does little things like that. So I guess I was more like looking at like, well, how did these people put these records together, and how did the people that I really love put these records together, you know? So it's like Bob Ezrin is obviously very good at it. He's, you know, The Wall and stuff like that. I'm trying to think of who else.
But you do respect lyricists, and you do like that. Like you're, like I said, like you're just laughing about me asking about the lyric sheet. It is important for you to convey something. It's not like you're dismissing the lyrics that you write. You just don't feel, don't feel comfortable elaborate. They are what they are.
Well, yeah, because I think you know, a lot of times people misinterpret lyrics anyways and get their own thing out of it. It's like, you know, like maybe you have a favorite song, and on one day the third line in the first verse is the thing you're like, oh my God, I love that line, and then later on you're like, oh my God, I really love the second and third line in the second verse, you know. Yeah. it's like as humans we change every day, and so I think nailing this down to being one thing is like, you know, it's like I'm not even going to feel that way about it necessarily in 6 months. So to expect somebody else to.
Yeah. I think there's so much going on in the record in terms of the music, and the vocals are multi-tracked, as I mentioned. Like it can be, I just want to thank you again for sending me. I don't imagine a lot of people are going to see these lyrics on the page.
No, they're not.
They're not included in the record, right? So,
no.
I just want to say, for what it's worth, I appreciated it. I was nice to see you come back to a verse and just alter one word sometimes. You do that. This is a thing you do a couple times on this record where you'll say a thing, and the next time we come across that verse, it's almost the same, but you've altered a couple of words that rhyme with the first ones, which is, you know, whatever. I don't mean that this isn't songwriting 101, but I do.
Is it?
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed reading them. I think they're really great lyrics. The music's fantastic. I want to commend you on doing this. It's great. And
awesome.
And it's inspiring to me because, as you know, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And for me to feel, even if no one else agrees or you don't think it's true, the feeling I've had is like, oh my God, at this point in our lifetime, Ian Blurton has made his most elaborate and ambitious record. I just want to say, like, even if you don't agree, I feel inspired by that. It's inspiring.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And just one thing I should probably add about the lyrics is that, like, Rob Taylor, who most people don't even know this, but Rob Taylor, who is the bass player in Change of Heart, he wrote a lot of the lyrics for the band, and I sang them, sort of thing.
Right.
And so he's always been my biggest influence in terms of that.
Hmm.
And so I always feel like I'm like, I have to, you know, sort of, I'm not judging myself against him, but I feel like there's like, he's got a peak that is quite high.
It's a nice shout out for Rob. That's gracious of you, and I'm glad you.
Oh, I mean, it's so true. It's like, yeah. I don't think necessarily the band would, people would remember it as much without some of the lyrics, because they resonate with people. You know?
Yeah, and they're hooky. I think it's fascinating to read some of the reviews that have come in for this record in particular, because you'll see people being like, more or less, one of the general themes I see in the reviews is, I can't believe how catchy this is. This is unusually infectious. Like, that's a huge compliment to your pop songwriting craft, if you will. Like, you manage everything you've done. Like, it's fascinating to me how well your pop sensibilities are always present.
Right.
Whether it's metal or hardcore punk or whatever sound is going on around you, that's in that's in your voice as well. I think I told you this in a phone call recently. My wife and I were desperately trying to assemble a barbecue. Took all day, and in the backyard, and I had this record playing, and I had started before my wife did, and she came out as your record was playing, and instantly knew it was you. Instantly, like, well, is there a new Come On record? That's what she initially said.
Right.
And I said, no, it's Ian's new thing. It's Future Now. And she's like, oh my God, he's just got such a distinctive voice. And I thought that was a very high compliment and astute on my wife's part. I'm going to compliment my wife on her compliment to you. Because I think that was...
I will as well.
I think that was very astute. You're your own thing. So as we're speaking... I haven't yet received the vinyl copy of this record that I ordered, but the album artwork, even in my digital realm here, stands out for me as really interesting. Can you talk a little bit about that? What's going on and who is responsible for this image?
Jeremy Brunel did the actual painting. Adam Swinburne did the logos. And Louis Duran did the whole layout of the whole package.
Yeah,
So it was really the three of them. Jeremy and I talked quite a long time ago, cause he put in crazy amount of hours on that painting. Like, it's an actual painting. It's not a,
And it was commissioned for the cover?
It was commissioned for the cover, and we worked pretty close together on it. In fact, he's the only other people that have the lyrics. But I gave him like, you know, 30 or 40 lines that I really liked from the record. And so he's incorporated them onto the cover. So it's like, if you're actually looking at the cover, it sort of is like a lyric sheet.
Okay, good. That's good to know. Okay. I just saw it, and it's quite, I don't know what the word is. The album cover is...
It's elaborate.
It's elaborate, and it's loud, if I may. Like, it's not bright colors per se. But it's like a lot of stuff is going on. And I can't wait to actually hold it in my hand so I can really stare at it. And I appreciate the fact now that you've revealed that there maybe are some lyrical, if it's not completely lyrical, Easter eggs.
I would say at least 80%.
That's awesome.
Lyrics.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to give a shout out there because I feel like, speaking of people who did a lot of work, I could see that on the cover. And again, I appreciate your attention to detail and Jeremy's as well. What's next for Future Now as we're speaking? I know you've got a couple of shows. Is that right?
No, only one. We're playing Saturday, August 13th at the Horseshoe Tavern in downtown Toronto with Sam Coffey and the Iron Lungs and Sick Things, who are from Montreal, who we did a split 7-inch with that came out in the spring. They're one of my favorite bands. I love them. They're old friends, so it's always great to see them. And we're about 75% finished our new record.
Another one.
So, yes.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah. So that's sort of where we're at right now.
And is there, when you say 75% done, have you done the lyric stuff yet?
Oh, yeah. The vocals are all done, and my guitars and Glenn's drums are all done.
Oh, nice.
I've actually started sort of mixing a song. But, yeah, it's pretty much done. Gregory from Sloan has been helping out with the backup vocals, too. So,
oh, lovely.
A little twist on the last record. So.
That's like his main gig, is singing backup vocals in Sloan and playing.
The man is a king at it. Oh, my God. Can you make it sound more Def Leppard? I sure can. Yeah.
Is that an instruction you gave someone?
Yeah.
Make it more Def Leppard. I didn't realize that. So you're ensconced in kind of 80s hard rock right now.
I don't know. I just think that backup, like the earlier Def Leppard backup vocals are pretty spectacular.
It's
a Mutt Lang thing, right, as well. Yeah. It's Queen too. So actually it's more, there's a lot of 70s.
Okay,
there.
Nice.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like Queen, Sweet, and Def Leppard. And they're all actually pretty similar.
Yeah, that's true, actually. That's true. So, are you... I don't want to hear too much, because I want to be surprised like everyone else, but, again, is there a conceptual aspect to the songs on the new record that you're picking up on already?
Conceptually, less singing. That's...
there's less singing.
Yeah, way less singing, and a little... It's just a lot more stripped down. The way I've always worked is I'm sort of reactionary to the record previous.
Right.
So it's a very stripped down record. There's actually, I don't think there's any double tracked vocals in any of the verses.
Oh, okay.
So it's just, yeah, it's like sort of taking away a lot of the stuff that we did on the last record.
And have you played any shows during the pandemic?
I haven't played a show in 2.5 years.
Holy
so
shit.
So this is my first show in 2.5 years.
Have you been to any?
I went and saw Black Crowes a couple weeks ago because the guitar player from Earthless is in the band. And
okay.
I mean, I like Black Crowes anyways, but that was a bonus for me. He's a fantastic guitar player.
Okay.
And yeah, he's shredded. And, you know, it was outside too. I actually haven't even been inside to a show or anything. So
it's probably going to be a bit weird.
Oh my God. It's going to be so weird.
But I think as soon as you start going, you'll forget.
About the
weirdness. So, well, that's exciting. If people want to learn more about Ian Blurton's future now, where would you send them on their telephones, their computers, and
just ianblurton.bandcamp.com has all my music. Or Instagram at Ian Blurton or Twitter at Ian Blurton.
Okay. And the record has it been distributed to record stores or is ordering?
Yeah, it's in a few stores. It came out on a US label called Seeing Red as well. So like basically the Canadian copies are more for shows.
Right.
And Thomas from Seeing Red is sort of taking care of the distribution outside of that.
Yeah. And they've got the colored vinyl. Is that correct?
Yeah, they have two color variants and a glossy cover, and the Canadian version is a matte cover with a bonus poster and all black virgin vinyl.
Shit, which one did I order? I think I ordered the one from your Bandcamp. Which one am I getting? Yours? Are you sending?
You're getting the black one. You're getting the black one with the poster.
So you're telling me I got to order the other one from Seeing Red? Okay, I'll do that. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that one too. I want the different one. I'm going to get both. Yeah, no, it's
three.
Is it a double? It must be a double. No, it's not. It's 45 minutes, right? It's 45 minutes.
No, yeah. It's 40 minutes.
Like, it's 40? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was very, very, very... Yeah, we actually had to chop an intro off a song to get the whole record to fit.
That's a thing I forgot to... I had it in my thoughts there. Is there anything that you recorded for this record that didn't make it on?
Yeah. Actually, there was the split 7-inch that we put out with Sick Things that came out on Yeah Right, a song called Bleed Out. Was recorded there. There's one song that will never see the light of day, and there's one extra song that'll probably come out in the fall.
Oh, okay,
that's
cool.
That's the last song that's from this whole session.
You didn't save anything and put it on whatever the new record's going to be. Nothing.
No, it's pretty different, actually.
Okay.
It's pretty different.
Okay, cool. Well, I appreciate this time. I want to go out on a song from this record, and I hope you can choose one for us to play. And also, doesn't matter how long it is, I'll just say that. And also, once you've chosen it, maybe tell us why it came to mind.
Oh, well, I would say probably Second Skin, the title track. It's got a bit of everything that's the record sort of about. It's got a, I don't know, King Crimson Breakdown. It's got the Mellotron. It's got the prog. It's got the, it's got solos. It's got how many solos? Three solos? I don't know. It's got a lot of solos. It's got a lot of singing. Glenn plays spectacular on this track, as does everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. There you go.
No, that's fine. This, it's the title track too, right?
Yes.
So that's easy for me to say. This is the title track from the beautiful new album, Second Skin, by Ian Blurton's Future Now. Ian, always an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. I hope you had...
Oh, my God. Thanks for having me.
I hope you had fun, and I wish you the best luck in the future.
Always have fun. 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 Always have fun.
On the farm, yeah, you take a deal. Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You know, all the way back in, I want to say it was 1997, Ian Burton was one of the first people I ever interviewed in my life. Did an article on him for the school newspaper, went to 3 Change of Heart shows that were playing at the university bar there in the winter of 97. So he means a lot to me. It's always meaningful for him to be, for him to be back on the show. I don't know if it's, well, I think it is meaningful to him too. I think he appreciates it. Ian, if you're listening, thank you once again for being on the 707th episode of Creative Control. Everyone else, this show is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this podcast. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. Some of it is derived from these interviews that you're hearing, these fresh interviews. We go do a little bit of overtime. Sometimes I dig into my archives, and maybe I'll someday, if I can convert some tape to digital, maybe I'll dig up the very first interview I ever did with Ian Blurton and feature it. Man, even I am skeptical about how good that might sound from my side of things, but who knows? That's the kind of stuff you get. Again, $6 or more a month gets you access to that stuff, but you can donate anything you want. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks, as always, to my friend Jim Guthrie for letting me use some music of his on this show. You can learn more about Jim and his work at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Ian Blurton. If you're unfamiliar with Ian, I hope you'll check out his work and got a good feeling about him from this chat. If you're a longtime fan, thanks for checking out Ian on this show. And hopefully you'll spread the word about it. Subscribe to this show. Follow it. Tell your friends about it. All that stuff helps me and the show thrive. So thank you in advance for that stuff. Thank you for listening to this. I hope you're well and will continue to be well. And I will talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.